shovels made. Snow shovels, that is.
Yes, never know.
Warm bodies. Speaking of temperature, getting another chance to outlet the building. It's completely drywalled now, so if you walk in, you can see the building. It's a pretty cool design. You look at it and see the different angles and stuff that are made, built in it. It's pretty cool. So, again, the risk of approbation for those who are applying, their SG3 will speak loudly enough for that. Everyone who's been involved in regards to it, that I appreciate it, and I can't wait to get into it. Getting satisfied, just gonna sit here and do my thing, but now you've got me all anxious and stirred up. So hopefully we'll get there. All right, make sure you're in fellowship as we are now dealing with the tactics that the false teachers use to appeal to, allure their victims in regards to their brand of teaching, ministries, etc., and then their self-serving victimizing that they engage in this respect. Peter tells us that these false teachers, first and foremost, are going to be successful, as many will follow their sensuality, beginning verse 2, and their sensuality looks at their appeal to the phallic lust trend of the human race, promising, if you will, sexual license and freedom under the principle of race or whatever they may distort in this respect as okay in regards to being a part of their churches and their ministries, seeking to rationalize those aspects of sexual sins that is otherwise proclaimed in God's plan. Sex is to be restricted in regard to the divine institution of marriage over and out. It doesn't get any clearer. Sex outside of the divine institution of marriage is a sin. This includes sensuality. This includes inappropriate dress, conduct, things of this nature. And God has designed for us to enjoy our physical bodies in this respect. But it is to be in regards to right man, right woman, and under the divine institution of marriage, aspect of the divine institution that obviously is hardly seen to be manifested much anymore in our society, apart from the fact that people obviously still have norms and standards in that area. But you listen to TV and things of this nature, marriage is just your own choice. If you want to be fine, if you don't, fine. We accept it, you know, whatever you want to do, your lifestyle, etc. And this is not the way God's designed it. Because of this very attack in regards to God's Word in this respect, we see the problems that we have in society, problems we have with children, etc., the family nucleus in this regard is being destroyed. And people wonder why, you know, things go the way they go, why God is postured in regards to being angry in regards to this country and society. And it doesn't stop there, as our society basically now is conditioning everyone to try to be tolerant. That's the word they like to use, tolerance, in regards to even abnormal perversion. And they like to label names on you if you stand up and speak the truth in the matter. Otherwise, it's like homophobic and things of this nature. Maybe you do a little good to have a little fear in your own life, the fear of God in this respect. And how a man has forgotten in regards to the permanent sign he's left on this planet, in regards to societies that want to embrace the homosexual way of life. Either way, it is the sexual trend that is one of the dominant STA areas of mankind, and these false teachers lock into that, and they seek to promise liberty and freedom in this respect to try to allure their numbers, build up their numbers, and have a following in this regard. And these types of false teachers that promote this type of immorality essentially are doing nothing more than what the pagan cults and religious practices did in regards to her own thing, and people look at the conduct of those flying the Christian banner, yet engaging in immorality of this nature. And Peter says, because of them, the way of the truth will be maligned. And this looks at the manner of life, the importance of our conduct in regards to those around us. People form an impression in regards to what the church is, what the local church stands for, what the believers that are part of the local church, what they exude in regards to their own lives, and they form an impression in regards to the faith. And here, obviously, in the early church, cliques of this nature within the church forms a bad impression. And people look at it, look at people that practice these types of things and say, you're no better than the rest of us and what we practice. What's the difference? See? And they obviously destroy the very aspect and reason for Christ going to the cross, God sending His Son, sacrificing His Son, and that is to deal with the problem of unrighteousness within the human race in regards to relationship with God. As we saw at point 17, Peter makes clear in both epistles as to the importance of Christian conduct impacting our witness. 18, that manner of life here is of issue, is embedded in the phrase, the way of the truth. 19, the title, the way, indicates a course of life here aligned with the sound truth of Bible doctrine. A course of life aligned with the sound truth of Bible doctrine, the way of the truth. 20, the term the way is a title given to the church early on to indicate those belonging to this new Christian faith. Acts 9:2. Saul, before it became Paul, breathing down the backs of the Christians, trying to persecute them, having some of them knocked off. And while he was still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, verse 1, against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked for letters from him to the synagogues at Damascus, so that if he found any belonging to the way, that is a title that was placed upon this new Christian faith. And you can only imagine, because they were saying the only way to heaven is through the person of Jesus Christ. It, hence, it's the way. See, this is the way. This is the way of the truth. So that was a title that was attached to the new Christian faith. 19:9-23, you see the title applied the same way, same vein. 19:9, that when some were becoming hardened and disobedient, speaking evil of the way before the multitude. Verse 23, about that time there arose no small disturbance concerning the way. New American Standard capitalizes it to in recognition of it being used as a title. 22:4, and I persecuted this way. Paul denoted his pre-salvation days. And then 24:14, but this I admit to you, that according to the way, which I call a sect, they're put into the same vernacular as you would any religious organization called a sect. 24:14, and other uses, etc., in the New Testament, referring to the church as the way. So Peter uses this term, tongue-in-cheek, if you will, to denote the manner of life of the Christian faith. So 21, Peter here obviously adds of the truth, the phrase of the truth, to emphasize biblically sound Christianity in contrast to those bringing discredit to it. And those who claim to be Christians does not mean ipso facto they're teaching you the truth of the Christian way. That comes only through the principle of sound hermeneutics and exegesis under the filling ministry of God the Holy Spirit. So he adds other truth to emphasize biblically sound Christianity in contrast to those bringing discredit to it. 22, the verb will be maligned. here is literally will be blasphemed. As our verb, blasphemeo. 23, those that adopted the immoral practices of the libertines. Another term used for these liberal Gnostics. The worst category, the unbelievers. They got involved because it's a way to make money. So those that adopted the immoral practices of the libertines brought disrepute upon all Christians, producing slander against the plan of God. Those outside see this kind of amoral activity being promoted. It's one thing for it to occur. It's another thing to promote it. It's two different levels of evil in that regards. And people look at that outside, and they would say, "Well, God's plan is really nothing. It's nothing more than any other human viewpoint religion." And then the term malign, we saw blaspheme being used in that way back in 1 Peter 4:4. That in all this they are expressed that you surprised that you do not run with them, the Gentiles, upon their pagan practices, to the same excess of dissipation, and they malign you. They blaspheme God's plan, and they do so when they attack the believer. In this vein. So part of, obviously, we have it in our Constitution to be a member of this church. You are to seek to avoid bringing disrepute in regards to the church. To conduct your life in such a way as to emulate what being a good Christian is all about. So we understand the importance of our conduct. So 24, those outside the church were naturally scandalized by those that claimed to be Christian and yet followed sexual freedom in the name of God and Christ. 25, it is hypocritical to proclaim a faith that promotes moral excellence, 2 Peter 1:5, and yet pursue unrighteousness or immorality as a course of life. As part of the Christian virtues, we are to supply moral excellence. That looks at accomplishing our phase two according to phase two doctrine. And that demands that we overrule the SGA so you can keep it isolated and pursue the righteousness of God and His plan. So it's hypocritical to proclaim a faith that promotes moral excellence and yet pursue unrighteousness in the course of life. 26, Paul uses a verb here, the same verb, malign in accusation of the Jews bringing disrepute upon God by their hypocrisy in Romans 2:24, that it has the notation of hypocrisy behind it, to be hypocritical. Romans 2:24. Term blasphemy. For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. That's a quote taken out of Isaiah 52:5. And he's again addressing the Jews under mainline Judaism. And he's pointing out that the hypocrisy, supposedly being God's priest nation, and yet they adhere and join themselves do that which is other than true doctrine, true Christian faith. So he uses the verb blaspheme in accusation of the Jews bringing disrepute upon God by their hypocrisy in Romans 2:24. 27, now a second charge of misconduct of these false teachers immediately follows now in verse 3. And in their greed they will exploit you with false words. So they appeal to the STA, here primarily the Phaedoclestrian of this group, to draw you into their circles. And now we see the actual agenda behind them. in so doing, getting people to follow them. And that is, in their greed, they will exploit you with false words. So 28, while some interpreters make their greed, which is poinexia in the Greek, inclusive of satiating their sexual lust, it here emphasizes specifically a material or monetary trend. These two verses, there's two dominant STA traits that are associated with these false teachers. First, Bailey, if you want to end sexual liberty, you can join our group. We're a swinging church. Whatever, you know, whatever. We'll rationalize for you. You can do what you want to do, and you're still part of God's people and God's our little church and our group. It's all about love, and they do that to draw you in, and then we see the reason why they're drawing you in. And here is because they are pursuing their monetary lust, the lust for money. Money in and of itself is okay, but it is not to be your God in life. And it is to be kept in a proper perspective. So 29. So again, while some commentaries want to say their greed includes their sexual satisfactions, here it's specifically looking at a monetary trend. 29, this is brought out by the verb they will exploit, which is emporumai, where we get emporium. That means to engage in business or trade. And in a bad connotation, means to take advantage of another financially. The only other time this verb is used, is in James 4:13, as we saw it back then when we did that book. Come now, you who say today or tomorrow we shall go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business. That's our term, emporium. Or who am I? Engage in business and make a profit. Leave Bible doctrine to financially better themselves. And he calls him down for that. James calls believers down for that, to be that arrogant, think that you can go off and make something else your God temporarily just to better yourself and leave Bible doctrine. You don't know what tomorrow will bring. God may decide, okay, I'll check you out on the way out there. Or right when you're coming back. That would be it. That would hurt at the Bema. So, in a bad connotation, this engaging in business, doing business, obviously, you know, it's exploitation, scamming, shamming, cheating, other synonyms, verse 30, at point 30, we might use the terms cheater, scam. It's a kind of a type of fraud, if you will. It's not forthright, not honest. But they're scamming, fleecing the flock, another term one might use in this connotation. 31, while the unsuspecting may think they have been introduced to freedom in life, in reality they have become slaves of these losers for their own material or monetary gain. We'll see that in verse 19, promising them freedom while they themselves are slaves of corruption. The promise of freedom. Become a liberal. Join the liberal denomination. You can do what you want to do. But the whole time, all they are doing is enslaving themselves. You put yourself under somebody's authority one way or the other in regards to churches. And you better make sure the authority is telling you the truth in regards to what they proclaim, what God's plan is in this respect. And all they're doing is becoming slaves, becoming the victims in regards to these own people's monetary gain. So 32, the New Testament warns spiritual leaders against this vice, to use the pulpit to better themselves especially, or to solicit money for themselves. All this crap you see out there in regards to televangelists and all this other stuff, trying to raise all this money, this is totally out of sync with God in regard to God's plan. Totally out of sync. It violates more than just one principle of doctrine. When you get your, first and foremost, just as we state in our Bible classes, you're to give not grudgingly nor of necessity. See, nor of necessity, it means overt coercion. Got to have the right mental attitude. Bible doctrine is what stirs you and moves you to apply in that area of your life. All this other stuff that churches get into, regards to yard sales and everything else to try to raise money. Where do you get that at? I don't see any example like that in the New Testament. So we strip ourselves of this commercial enterprise that churches are involved in today, and one of the reasons why we have such a hassle in regards to even having a church building anywhere without having to go through the hassles of laws that have been passed because the church has abused God's privileges given to them. Well, I got off on that pretty easily today, didn't I? But that's it. So, Bible warns pastors not to abuse their pulpit in this fashion. 1 Timothy 3:3, it's all to be taken within the proper perspective, the proper balance. Obviously, regards to the giving, the number one priority of the local church financially is to support the pastor. But the people, the sheep, are to apply this based on their own grace orientation and understanding Bible doctrine and how God prospers them in their life. But otherwise, I don't stand up here and ask you for funds so I can go buy me a new color TV. I'll go to the board for that. 1 Timothy 3:3. In regards to the godliness code, the pastor teacher candidate is to be free from the love of money. And money's not what drives you. And it's a damn good thing to not have that trend and be in the ministry. And because people get under their SCAs, they end up doing stupid things otherwise. Try to align themselves with other religious organizations to raise money for the church and things of this nature. It's completely out of God's will. Titus 1:7 in the exhortation to Titus, where the overseer, the pastor, must be above reproach, as God's steward, not self-willed, not quick-tempered, not addicted to wine, not pugnacious. I'm not a brawler that go out picking fights, not fond of sordid gain, monetary trend. 1 Peter 5:2. Shepherd the flock of God among you, exercising oversight not under compulsion, but voluntarily, according to the will of God, and not for sordid gain, but with eagerness. God will take care of you. He took care of you your whole life until you got there. Why wouldn't He keep on taking care of you? Paul himself took particular care to avoid suspicion. And this had a lot to do in regards to establishing churches. And in contrast to false teachers who operated under this particular STA trend to go out and try to raise money for their ministries, etc. And Paul avoided that. Acts 20:33 and following. After the exhortation to the shepherds, to watch themselves and be on guard for the flock. Paul states in regards to his own ministry, I have coveted no one's silver or gold or clothes. Monetary trend, lust for the details, things of this nature, he keeps it all in perspective. The things of life, he keeps them in perspective and the proper balance. And not after people's riches. Rather, he would obviously be pleased when God blessed people otherwise. You yourselves know that these hands ministered to my own needs to the men who were with me. And this especially applicable as what we call the Pauline privilege. when he evangelized, he wouldn't ask for money. When he go in and present the gospel phase one and seek and try to establish a church, money was a taboo subject. I'm not here for the money. I'm here to give you the good news. And then, obviously, as they might be established, etc., then he would teach the doctrine necessary in order to support a church. If you're going to have a local church, you got to have logistical and physical support in that regards. And on the other end, he teaches regards to the farmers receive the first share of the crops, etc. But otherwise, he kept his hands clean in that respect. Verse 35, and everything I showed you, that by working hard in this manner you must help the weak and remember the words of the Lord Jesus, that he said himself, it's more blessed to give than to receive. And that's the right mental attitude in regards to the pastor, but that's his application. It's not up to everybody else to determine whether he gives or not. I can just almost hear wheels turning sometimes. Oh, well, you don't need the money. Well, that's my privilege. That's my obligation. Not yours. It's your obligation to apply the doctrine otherwise. See, that's the way it goes. 34, the false teachers covered their greed. These false teachers covered their greed by using false words. That's plastos logos. How they would paint their greed, maintaining a godly appearance otherwise. 35, in other words, they use specious arguments, which specious means having an appearance of legitimacy. That sounds good. Trouble is, you've got to look at the doctrine and see if it's sound. So they would use specious arguments to persuade and manipulate believers to give large sums of money into their hands. Like you seed ministry. You plant the seed, plant $10 and watch God bless you with 50, you know, or whatever. That's what they sound like, W.C. Field. Oh yeah, I'll make you rich. That's part of, you know, it sounds good. You know, wrench a verse out of context somewhere about God blessing you in regards to your giving. And never tell their sheep, well, now, God may still test you, and he may make you dirt poor, and you have to go to church for living grace all the time. They won't tell you that. They'll tell you, if you send me money, God will bless you hand over fist in this regard. See? And they use the Bible, obviously, to try to promote their lies in this regard. And they cover it up by using persuasive arguments of why you should. I'll let the Bible argue my case. 36, the history of Christianity is filled with ministers and priests who exploited their people for financial gain. Now, obviously, you have the different levels of evil in this regard. One of the things you look at is, you know, like in Roman Catholicism, how churches are just have this immense wealth, and they're still out there begging the most poor people around for more money instead of helping them. You go, what's wrong with this picture? Is that what Jesus would do? What's my basic say? No, Jesus says it's time for lunch. So this, obviously, this whole concept, this idea, this fact has been a part of church history. People taking advantage, getting into the ministry in order to promote themselves, better themselves financially, etc. People get into ministry for all kinds of things, but this one is obviously dominant. And it's been filled with authorities of this ilk. 37, Jesus taught against abuse of this kind from the pulpit in the parable of Luke 12, 42 through 48, dealing with the four categories of spiritual leaders, as I made side reference to in the first session, Luke 12, 42 through 48. 1242 in regards to culpability, the liability that the pastor takes upon himself in regards to their positions as a shepherd, Luke 12, and you have four categories that Christ brings out here. This parable, verse 42, the Lord said, "Who then is a faithful and sensible steward?" The steward there is the one that is to manage the household in the absence of the owner, and that would be the pastor. Then his master will put in charge of his servants to give them their rations at the proper time. That's the dissemination of Bible doctrine, the feeding the sheep scenario. And he asks the question, who is the faithful and sensible steward who will do this? Verse 43, blessed, denoting the area of blessing, is that slave whom his master finds so doing when he comes, that he sticks with his knitting and fulfills his job requirements throughout his life. Truly I say to you that he will put him in charge of all his possessions. He'll give him essentially an inheritance, a huge inheritance. And that again looks to the aspect of the prize, etc. But then he gives in contrast to the one, the pastor doing his job. And the first one deals with the same types of people that Peter's emphasizing, the unbeliever. Those who want to step into the role, want to put on the robe, put on the collar, or whatever. See. But if that slave says in his heart, "My master will be a long time in coming," begins to beat the slaves, both men and women, and eat and drink and get drunk. Abuse of the pulpit, see. Of taking advantage of the situation and circumstance to appeal and satiate his own STA. The master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect him, and in an hour he does not know, and will cut him in pieces, assign him a place with the unbelievers. So that looks at the unbeliever that steps into the role of the ministry carrying the Christian banner. Now there are people that will stand before Christ and at the great white throne judgment and say, "That did we not prophesy in your name? Did we not cast demons out in your name?" He'll say, "Be away from me, I don't know you." And people use Christianity as a formula in a lot of aspects of life, but they're not really believers. I was reminded of that. I was watching some self-proclaimed demon exerciser. And I'm not talking about jumping jacks. You know, go out and try to exercise demons. And they use all this rigmarole. And take him days sometimes to get these demons to leave. I said, "Man, that guy's walked right into the demons." All Jesus had to do was say, "Get the hell out of there. Move. Leave." And they're gone. That's just Satan, you know, pulling the wool over people's eyes again. And you wonder, you know, if that guy's even a believer. Could he be one of those guys? That's the very thing. Wow, I wonder if he'll be one of those guys at the great white throne we'll see. Now I get to remember, I saw you on TV. And you'll be flipping me off all the way. But anyway. Then you have the next level here. A pastor and that slave who knew his master's will and did not get ready or act in according with his will, he'll receive many lashes. This looks at the communicator that obviously he's got the Bible in front of him. He knows what he's supposed to be doing, but he deters. He gets off the straight and narrow. Doesn't really get locked in. You know, you classify it like the Fundy preachers. That would be in this category. They're going to be held culpable. See, they'll be held culpable, and judgment's going to come on in one form or fashion by God. But then you have one that's even worse than that. But the one who did not know it and committed deeds worthy of a flogging will receive but few. So that's the contrast. You've got the one who did know, okay. Straighten back up here. One that did know, he's extremely culpable compared to the one who didn't know the funding. and from everyone who hath been given much shall must be required, to whom they entrust much, of him they will ask all the more. So the first one, verse 47, I got ahead of myself, is the pastor who knows doctrine and then leaves, takes his sheep some other direction. And his judgment is going to be greater in that way than the one, the normal funding. The funding is better off than a person in my position, if you ask me, according to this verse, in regards to culpability before God and to avoiding judgment in time, etc. Or peeling off, knowing the truth, and then, you know, capitulating. So, you have obvious abuse of the pulpit. And Christ makes it very clear, the culpability factor, and a warning not to go off and do something stupid, see, such as trying to fleece the sheep. 38, now the phrase false words here, those two words, is antonymous, it's an antonym, if you will, to the phrase the way of the truth. False words is contrasted to the way of the truth. 39, it draws a picture of these scam artists waving the Bible in the air while misrepresenting its words in order to get their followers to give. And that's exactly what you usually see. You got a Bible, and I flop it open and give you one verse up there and deal and do their thing. The next thing you know, Bible's closed, got it up in the air, whatever, and send us your money. He said, send us money so this ministry can continue to exist. Well, what if God doesn't want it to exist? What if he wants to shut it down? Well, they're not going to recognize that. See, people don't think that God closes doors. And they're all under energy of the flesh. That's all it is. And that's the picture you get when you put false words with the way of the truth. Way of the truth. I'm lying out of my teeth. See. So that's the picture drawn there. And these people are nothing but scam artists. Obviously, you've got the degrees. People are worse than others. 40, unfortunately, the sheep get what they deserve, as they generally have no more interest in the truth than their leaders. And that's kind of the irony. I mean, you got really intelligent people that are locked into ministries like this. I mean, where do you think they get their money from? There's people out there that are professional professionals. They're excellent at what they do. They make a lot of money. God just doesn't want any of them to come to church like ours. Leave them out there. See. And doctors, lawyers, and I'm not saying they're all that way. I know doctors and lawyers are on doctrine. But overall, and they're just as blind as their leaders. 41, what we have here is a case of the blind leading the blind while picking their pockets. The best way I could put it. And again, Jesus teaches in regards to those who are spiritually blind, assuming roles like this. And they're there, if you will, to take the key. A lot of the riffraff, you know, out of our problems, out of our hair. Matthew 15, 14. In regards to the Pharisees, the spiritual leaders of Jesus' time, let them alone. They are blind guides of the blind. If a blind man guides a blind man, both will fall into a pit. They will get what they can. It's all based on choice, the sect that they choose to adhere to. 42, however, whatever gain they may enjoy temporarily, Peter assures his readers they will not escape future judgment. Whatever Mercedes and big mansions and all this other stuff, you hear some of these people being successful enough in their racket to engage in. One thing Peter wants everyone to make clear, to understand clearly, that they will not escape future judgment. They will answer just like everybody else does in this world. So 43, there is a certain poetic rhythm In other words, their judgment from long ago is not idle, and their destruction is not asleep. 44, the words judgment here and destruction, which is tokrima, verse for judgment, and hey, apolia, for destruction. We saw that one in verse 1 used two times. It's almost personified, as judgment is said not to be idle, u argeo, and destruction is not asleep, u nastazo. It's almost personified in regards to their actions, being idle or asleep. So 45, when the wicked are successful and their misdeeds go unpunished, men tend to misinterpret the apparent inactivity and become discouraged, or worse, act lawless themselves. And that's part of the hazard one must avoid. As time goes on in history, people getting their eyes off of God and on people, and they see them being successful in their activity and, you know, going, well, you know, if I just try a little of this, I could build up my numbers. If I go do this and join them in this one, you know, we could probably raise more money or whatever, you know. And people see how they go, and they think, well, you know, God's not doing anything here. And so I might as well just jump in the bandwagon and start rationalizing my own Christian life. But that is the wrong way to approach it. And if you keep your eyes on people, that is why plus H is robbed from you in regards to your own life. You become discouraged. You become sour in regards to things around you, rather than looking at what God is doing for you in your Christian life and keeping your eyes on your eternal niche, your SG3 package, and the prize, etc. in this respect. So that is part of the hazard of living a Christian life. And Peter is going to further emphasize this principle in regards to the examples that will follow these verses to bring this about, to show that historical precedence proves that God does intervene in judgment in regards to those who are lawless and rebellious spiritually. And it's important for the church to understand that straight off the bat, because some 2,000 years, some 2 millennia, it looks like time's just going on, and evil's left to thrive in regards to itself, false teachers coming out, becoming dominant, etc. on the landscape, and people becoming impatient, and you know, caving in at the last moment, etc., and things of this nature. God's not ever going to come back. And you have the mockers that will come in and even try to highlight that. To recognize this is just history, but God's patient, and He has a plan, and His plan will be fulfilled according to His timing. But don't be misled. Judgment will still be judgment, and it will still come, just as it has in the past, and will once again. He wiped this planet clean one time of all unbelievers. He's going to do it again. He's going to have it up to here. When it's up to there, that's when He spits us out, and then that's when He wipes the planet clean again, another 7 years. Almost makes you feel Italian. Don't fall through. I learned that from some Italian lady that I know that I don't get there. So when the wicked are successful and their misdeeds go unpunished, men tend to misinterpret the apparent inactivity and become discouraged, or worse, act lawless themselves. 46, yet as Peter will make clear, God ultimately intervenes with His perfect timing. 47, God's verdict has already been pronounced against them, and the doom they surely will that surely will overtake them has been set in motion from long ago. That's et pole, the adverb. From long ago. God perfectly foreknew history, every aspect of it, everything that would occur, and He has already pre-designed to intercede according to His perfect timing in this respect. He knew all this was going to happen, and He already had His plan set out. This is how I'm going to deal with it. with perfect judgment in this respect. And his plan, when he created us, that plan was set in motion. So 48, keeping unbelievers in emphasis here via the context. They die and face phase 3 wrath in Sheol, Hades. 49, as a group, looking at the plural use of pronoun there, their judgment, plural, their counterparts will enter great tribulation and be destroyed from the planet of judgments of the 7 years for experiential overruling of God in judgment. That's what Peter will get into, is God's overruling will. So 50, those that are believers will stand before the judgment seat of Christ and experience shame and loss on their part. 51, the unbelievers will be further humiliated at the great white throne judgment. All right, we'll go ahead and time's almost up. We'll just call it here and we'll pick up the verses Tuesday evening. Father, again, we thank you for the truth of your word. We ask God the Holy Spirit to continue to lighten us these things in Jesus' name. Amen.